Thank you all for coming this evening. So I'm afraid the title of tonight's talk is a little ambitious, Neo-Buddhism, A New Vision. And I came across that because, I've been working with this material for quite a long time, the Buddhist texts and the practice of meditation. And, gradually as I get older, I start to understand more of it as time goes on. And there's a certain way that I've been coming around recently to understanding these teachings, which I find really helpful, and I think it may be helpful to others. And this way of understanding things that I'm going to try to lay out for you tonight, I'm calling it Neo, because I think it's a new idea. I don't understand why it's a new idea, because it seems from my understanding of the classical sources that this should have been or could have been or maybe might have been what the Buddha was saying all along. I don't know. But this thought that I'm reaching for, I haven't quite fully thought before. I haven't quite fully figured it out. And so I'm going to kind of make it up as I go tonight. But I want to stumble through. I've always considered you here in Cambridge to be a friendly audience, so I hope you'll bear with me. I want to try to stumble through some of the conundrums that are embedded in these teachings and help sort of articulate a solution to some of those conundrums that I find really helpful. Now, when you create something new or call something new, I don't mean by doing so to critique anything that's gone before. Remember the whole lesson of the blind men and the elephant wasn't so much that different people can look at the same phenomenon and come up with different interpretations of what it means. But the point of that story was that that when you have different perspectives on things, the trouble only starts when somebody says, only this is true and nothing else. So those nine men with the elephant, when they all had a different view of what the elephant was, that was fine. Diversity and plurality can live side by side in harmony until somebody steps up and says, this is the right way, this is the only way to look at it, and everybody else is wrong. That's when the fighting starts. And it turns out that king brought those blind men together all for an entertainment for him, because he thought it was funny to see these blind men fighting with each other. They came to fisticuffs at the end of the story because they disagreed on the nature of the elephant. So the point of my saying that is simply that this way that I'm going to try to articulate how to understand the core Buddhist teachings is not meant to be some new innovation. It's not meant to be a critique of anything that's gone before. It's just a view. It's just a perspective. It's just one way of looking at things. I think you'll find that it's something that can be potentially very helpful in practice. It's helped me understand a lot better how to come at practice of meditation. So it has something to do with awakening. What is awakening? Enlightenment. It has something to do with non-self, that perplexing but central Buddhist idea of selflessness. It may have something to do with rebirth. I'm not quite sure about that yet. It may or may not have implications for rebirth, but it certainly has implications for how we approach practice in the moment, and it might even have some implications for how we might go about saving the world from disaster. So let's start with this notion of awakening. This came to my mind recently because just a few weeks ago, I wrote an essay for the next Tricycle that's coming out, and I've been writing for them for years. And the essay starts with a question, isn't it about time somebody got awakened? all this practice, you know, where, when's the show go on, so to speak? And it's asking a very old question, you know, that the Buddhists have been struggling with forever. And that is, you know, where are the arhats? Where are the Buddhas? If this whole thing is about clearing the mind and becoming awakened, where are the exemplars in our time, in our generation, that sort of instantiate that, show what it looks like? What does it look like for a person to be awakened? Not as some sort of icon in the you know, Buddhist art, but as a living example. You know, there's a lot of people in our generation, a lot of people in our community these days that are doing a lot of practice, that are doing a lot of study, that understand this stuff well, and yet we're not seeing the kind of results of that we might hope or expect for. So I'm asking the question, what exactly would awakening look like in our own world? And that means looking at it somewhat differently than the traditional way. Maybe or maybe not. You see, during the Buddha's lifetime, awakening seemed to be a psychological goal, a goal of psychological transformation that he himself demonstrated under the Bodhi tree when he was still middle-aged, was this sort of clearing the mind of its toxins, clearing the mind of greed, hatred, and delusion, such that the cessation of suffering occurred, and he then lived for 45 years as a more or less normal person, in the sense of, you know, dressing and eating and walking and talking and sleeping and so forth. But he was awakened. And moreover, in his lifetime, a lot of other people were awakened. Matter of fact, it seemed almost ridiculously easy to be awakened. You know, these people hear one discourse and they sort of get a breakthrough, and then they go off to the forest and practice diligently for a little while, and then they're one of the arhats, you know. When the Buddha passed away, you know, he says there are a lot of people sitting around here that are awakened here and now in this lifetime. The poetry left by the monks and nuns are all a test to their waking up. Done is what had to be done, they say again and again in these verses. No more will I be reborn. The Buddha's project has been completed. I'm no longer suffering. The mind has woken up. Well, you know, we should do that too. You know, I'd like to see what that looks like in our world. One of the conundrums is that this notion of awakening, which seemed to be accessible in one lifetime during the Buddha's life, as the tradition evolves over time and moves through Asia, it seems to become more and more of a distant accomplishment, you know? Before too long, the whole mythology of Buddhism evolves, and you get this notion that, you know, a person has got to spend multiple lifetimes perfecting certain virtues, the paramis or paramitas, and even foregoing a sort of personal psychological transformation for more of a cosmological attainment, becoming one of the Buddhas that begins their own Buddha field, Buddha world, and so forth. The whole thing becomes very large and very far away. And then it sort of comes back close with the Zen tradition, where we seem to have a lot of iconoclastic people, mostly men, of course, walking around waking up and doing these strange things and demonstrating their non-attachment and their non-dual awareness and so forth. But I want to go back to the early days and understand, well, what does this awakening consist of? Well, for one thing, the word nibbana, that is the word for awakening. We used to call it enlightenment, but etymologically, Buddha and Buddhi and Bodhi really comes from the verb to wake up. So awakening is better. And it seemed like that word was used as an adjective in the early texts, especially in the Atikavaga, the very earliest part of the Sutta Nipata, this sort of collection of verses, where that is to say that nirvana was used to describe a person. A person has become extinguished. Nibbana literally means extinguishing, extinction, the going out. And the way we hear about it is the going out of the flames of greed, hatred, and delusion. The way the Buddha described it most often during his lifetime is that raging in our unconscious mind, raging in our heart, are these three fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. Nibbana has to do with quenching the fires. The fires have gone out. There's all kinds of metaphors of around becoming cool, you know, is one of the words they use. But that can only be applied to a person. So when they say that the Buddha has attained nirvana, they're basically saying that the Buddha has become extinguished. Now, do we take that to mean that he's no longer exists as a person? That the person has been extinguished and no longer exists? Clearly not, because he, you know, persists for 45 years. When the word as an adjective is being applied to the person, the Buddha has become extinguished, what they're saying is that within this person, the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion have been extinguished. So it's not that the person is extinguished, it's that the toxins have been extinguished. And that's what transforms him. In that moment, at dawn, on the night of his awakening, suddenly all of the asavas, the toxins have dried up. All of the craving has been removed. All of the darkness has been cleared away, and the mind shines brightly like a moon, full moon, coming out behind a cloud. All these lovely metaphors. But it's describing the transformation of a person, the psychological transformation of a person. And that, I think, is an important clue, a very important clue for us on how we might recover and reinstantiate this notion of awakening in our own lives, in our own practice, in our own world. Everything got a lot more complicated 45 years later when the Buddha passed away. And we're not even allowed to say he died, you know, he passed away. And that's the final nibbana, the parinibbana, the complete extinguishing. And there, it all gets very complicated because we, you know, there the Buddha as a person really does get extinguished. He's no more. He dies. One of the last things he says before he passes away, you know, this body is beat up. It's 80 years old. It's falling apart. It's racked with pain from dysentery. And, you know, in this very poignant exchange with Ananda just before he dies, he said, you know, what do you expect? All conditioned things fall apart, go away, cease to become. And that's going to happen with me as well. So the Buddha really did become extinguished as a person. He no longer was there. Now, this is where the rebirth stuff comes in a little bit, because, of course, the Buddhist tradition isn't saying that he was annihilated, that he ceased altogether. But it can't also say that he was reborn, because he wasn't. He was past rebirth altogether. So the whole sort of mystery of what does awakening mean in the light of the doctrine of what is a person, self or non-self, that's where that part comes in and it gets more complicated. So what is a person? You know, how did persons get into all this? One of the things that the Buddha is saying consistently throughout his teachings is that, you know, personality, character, this notion of being an individual, a self, is a concoction. It's a view. It's a narrative. It's a story. That it works at a certain level of scale, and it's a very useful concept, you know, in our lives, legally, professionally, and so forth, to talk about this person and that person. But like everything else in nature, if you zoom in close enough, the concept loses its coherence. And when you get down to the level of just phenomena arising and passing away, at a certain point, the concept of personhood no longer applies. You know, if you look at any part of our body closely enough, it's just this or that cell, or this or that molecule, or this or that atom, doing what atoms and molecules and cells do, you know, turning over in some way and transitioning and so forth. When you look in really close, this sense of the identity of a person really loses its meaning. We have to sort of pan back. We have to pull back and look at a larger thing. You know, you take all of these cells together, all of these organs together, all of this within this one body. Now we can start calling that a person when it has a certain past and a certain future, and we can create stories and give attributes to it and so forth. And the same sort of thing happens with our practice. You know, when we, you know, come here and walk through the door, we're a person. You know, our personality is there, and we meet and greet friends and talk about our day and so forth. Once we get in here and the bell goes off and we've been sitting 10 or 15 minutes, that whole sense of who you really are really falls apart. I mean, if you're actually able to simply be aware of the breath as it rises and falls, be aware of moments of experience as they rise or fall, the context that creates these are my feelings, these are my breaths, this is my body, that all falls away. And it's really just this phenomena arising and passing away, arising and passing away. So how is it that this word for awakening adheres to a person? You see, one of the ways it was put in the early texts is that greed, hatred, and delusion are deeply rooted in the human psyche. They use that word, the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. And out of those roots come all kinds of unhealthy and unwholesome behaviors and intentions and actions and thoughts and so forth. An arhant or a Buddha, someone like the Buddha, is someone who has undergone such a psychological transformation that those toxic roots are completely pulled up. They're removed entirely. So for most people, you know, there can be a moment when there's no greed, you know? Kind of like grass being cut off, you know? Your greed can come up, or hatred can come up, annoyance can come up, and we can sort of see it and understand it and let go of it, the sort of abandoning unwholesome states that have arisen as part of our practice. That can happen. But we know by doing that we're treating the symptom instead of the cause of the affliction. We know that if we abandon our annoyance for this moment, it's going to come back again before too long, or tomorrow morning, or whatever, you know. And so the idea is, you know, we're all a work in progress, you know. These toxins are constantly arising in our experience, these five hindrances: sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt. That's our bread and butter. I mean, those things are happening all the time in our experience, and we watch them come and go. And as part of our practice, we can learn to abandon them under certain circumstances by changing our relationship to what's happening, changing our understanding of what's happening, and so forth. But we know that basically they're still there in a latent form. You know, the teaching on effort, right effort in meditation, you know, classically, as I'm sure many of you are aware, you know, talks about abandoning unwholesome things that have arisen, but also sort of protecting against, guarding against the unwholesome things that are unarisen. In other words, the Buddhists recognize this whole unconscious mind that's got all of these toxic tendencies in a latent or dormant state, but they can be triggered at any time by various things. So this is where a person comes in. A person is someone with, you know, a body and consciousness and perception and feeling, these abilities of the mind to figure out what's going on and whether it feels good or bad. And then these whole set of emotional responses, this whole sort of character and personality traits and so forth that really define who we are. And those are unique, and they build up in layers, and they've got healthy and unhealthy characteristics and so forth. So we talk about a person being unenlightened or enlightened, awakened or unawakened. But you're only technically awakened like the Buddha was. You're only an arhat when those fires have gone out once and for all. I mean, we can quench the fires, but they're still there as coals in a latent state, and then they'll flare up again. For the arhat, it's like the fires have gone out to such an extent that they've, I don't know, poured water on them or whatever, so that they can't reignite. That's the arhat. Now, before the Buddha passed away, you know, many times during his teachings, he talked about people at different sort of stages, we call it now, of awakening. There's the non-returner and the once-returner and the stream-enterer and so forth. And the idea is that these are people whose toxins or whose some yojanas, their fetters, their ties, their chains are loosened, you know, that the toxins are diminished. There are 10 of these constraints or restraints. And, you know, if you let go of 5 of them, then you've attained a certain stage. And you let go of another 2, you've attained another stage. And, you know, at that last stage, you've only got 1 left. And so there's this kind of model of a gradual purification of the mind, of these toxic tendencies and elements and so forth. But these words, stream enterer, once returner, you can tell by the ending of the word, er, these are agent nouns. So these are nouns, these are defined as persons who have the quality of being almost awakened but not quite, because their toxins are largely extinguished but not completely extinguished. And so, you know, there's this critical tipping point. Either you're still prone to these, you know, primitive instincts erupting in the mind and the heart, or you're not. And that's the difference between awakening or not awakening. Well, this brings us to the innovation that I'm trying to suggest, the sort of the punchline of all this. What if, instead of thinking of awakening in terms of persons, we thought of awakening in terms of moments? Moments of experience. So the other way to come to this whole notion of non-self is using this model of of a person as a process. You know, the non-self doctrine isn't saying that we don't exist. It's saying that we exist in a certain way and not in the other way. Now, there's two senses of the word exist in English. One is something that's real, true, ontologically valid, that is, it is. But the other way we use the word being or existence in English is as a process. It's that something happens. It's not a thing. It's an event. And that's what they're talking about, the self. It's not a thing. It's an event. It's as simple as that. We think of the person as something that exists, an entity. And all the Buddhists are saying is, let's shift to process thinking instead of static thinking. The person, if you look, never actually exists as any particular thing. It's constantly changing. If something arises and passes away, it's never really there. It never exists. It's always becoming. So they're simply applying different language. They're saying that the self is something that constantly becomes. It constantly happens. It doesn't actually be. A good metaphor that I've stumbled across for this is, you're going to love or hate this one, the Boston Red Sox, or any given team, you know, a sports team. A baseball game, is that something that exists? No. A game is something that happens. People get together and they go out and they do a certain thing, set of things for a certain period of time, and we call that the game. You know, the players change all the time, the positions change, the managers change over the years and so forth and so on. It's the same thing with the human being. We are constantly, moment after moment, enacting ourselves. We're evolving. We're doing stuff. We never actually are any configuration. We're always a response to something that's happening. So if we bring that idea and put it next to this idea of awakening, then what that means is that we're not trying to become a person who, that is an entity, who gets a different adjective. Instead of being called unawakened, now we're going to call them awakened. This person has attained awakening. Instead of that, we're going to look and say, this person is evolving moment by moment. In any given moment in their experience, there is going to be some complex set of factors. And that complex set of factors is either going to include one or another of these three toxins, greed, hatred, delusion, or not. So the whole sort of Abhidharma analysis of the human being, the whole sort of thrust of Buddhist psychology, is really analyzing what seems like a solid person into a series of processes and flowing events. And so it's saying, for example, that any given moment there's a stimulus that enters one of the sense doors, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind, that there's the arising of consciousness, which is the contact between the sense organ and the sense object, that based on that contact, there's some feeling tone about whether it feels good or bad, there's some perception about what it is based on our history and our learning and our experience. We identify it with a word or a label or tell a story about it or something. And then there's a whole emotional response. How do we react to what's this, what's happening, what's arising? We react with attachment. We react with aversion. We react with affection. We react with equanimity, whatever. And every single moment, that configuration changes. Those five aggregates I just mentioned all arise together, interact with one another in a unique and specific way in that moment, and then collapse. And the next moment, another set arises, and another, and another. This is the way that we enact ourselves, or perform ourselves, or flow on as a process, moment after moment after moment. So here's the rub. The issue now becomes not, are you an awakened person or not, but is this an awakened moment or not? And if there is a moment that is devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion, then that moment is structurally identical to that moment when the Buddha was awakened. That is to say, in the moment of his awakening, when, you know, the skies rained flowers and so forth, is defined by the early text as simply the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, for the Buddha at that moment, the footnote to that absence was that, and by the way, the mechanism that will recreate greed, hatred, and delusion, any form at any time, has been completely destroyed. So he is no longer capable of being annoyed at anything, of being addicted to anything, of being, you know, confused about anything. Now, I, for one, and I suspect most of us, wouldn't necessarily expect to be able to get to that point of no longer being capable of getting annoyed or greedy or anything. But I would argue and pose to you the proposition that we are all capable of having moments that are free of greed, hatred, and delusion. Matter of fact, it might even be the case that many of our moments are devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion. Right now, you might be in a mind state that is not particularly agitated. That's not particularly suffering. That's not particularly in despair or confusion or reaching or grabbing or hating or anything. A moment of serenity, a moment of tranquility, a moment of equanimity, a moment of mindfulness, by definition in Buddhist psychology, is a moment devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the place where this makes such an impact on practice that I find for myself is that it's not like, you know, I'm practicing to attain something in the future. Practice is simply, can I hold myself in this particular moment such that those toxins are not present? They're not active. They're not functioning. You know, I think the basic notion of awakening is not reaching for some state or condition outside of ourselves. I think that's really a perversion of Buddhism that came in through its encounter with other religious traditions. I think Buddhism is largely like the other pre-Brahmanical traditions in India, like Jainism and Ajivikas and so forth. I think it's mostly a matter of looking inside and finding the peace that's already there. That is, the awakening, which later gets called Buddha nature and all of that, really from the early days is simply saying, we are naturally capable of being without greed, hatred, and delusion. We are naturally capable of being at peace, being whole, being well. But much of the time we're not. So the issue is always to find, what is it that's keeping us off balance? What is it that's pulling us from this quiet center? And then if we can identify that, we kind of relax it, we let it go, we turn away from it. It's kind of like trying to get the body comfortable, you know? You know, this part here kind of hurts, so you wiggle it into a different position. Now it feels good. Then some other part doesn't fit, so you wiggle that into position. Eventually you can get to a position where you're feeling complete calm. You feel completely okay for a moment. Then a moment later, something else comes in. So whether it's physical, you know, your foot's falling asleep or the room's too hot or something is making you feel like I'm not okay in this moment, or whether it's something psychological, you know, like, you know, thinking about what I have to do tomorrow or thinking about what somebody said to me yesterday or thinking about my, you know, the stresses in my life or whatever. You know, or whether it's something even more deeply psychological, that old habit of having unexplained anxiety, unexplained compulsions, unexplained depression, and so forth. These are all tangles and knots and little impingements on your natural peace, your natural well-being. And when one of those impingements comes in, you kind of let go of it. And you find the place without it. And even if it's only for one moment, I submit anybody in almost any circumstances can find a moment of well-being, can find a moment of not suffering. I mean, we're told one of the great myths of Buddhism, I think, is that we're all driven to this practice by suffering, you know. We're all suffering, and so we look to the practice to find relief from our suffering. Well, I'm not entirely sure that's the case. I mean, for many people, of course, it would be, but not for everyone. I don't think that Siddhartha was driven to his path by suffering. He had it made. He was a prince. Everything was going fine. He was driven by something else, by compassion, by trying to find a, you know, the highest adventure of life or whatever. And in the same way, I think many of the moments that we inhabit as modern human beings are moments without suffering. Yes, there is suffering. I don't mean to, you know, downplay it, and especially, you know, sometimes some of us are in chronic pain, or some of us have really deep psychological wounds, or some of us are in really challenging situations, and I don't mean to diminish all of that. But there are still moments that you can find within that, even if it's for a moment. And I think what the Buddha was leaving us was a roadmap of how to negotiate our way into those internal spaces within our experience that, if only temporarily, can be devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think our meditation texts are really revealing that very clearly. You know, the main text for Vipassana meditation, the Satipatthana Sutta, it's called, the discourse on the foundations or the establishment of mindfulness. In the fourth foundation, where it talks about mindfulness of mental objects, when they talk about the hindrances, for example, They simply say, when the hindrance, let's pick one, the hindrance of ill will, of aversion, in its strongest form, this is hatred. And this is what drives all the violence and the racism and the injustice in the world. But at its other end of the same spectrum, it can be very mild. Anytime you're slightly annoyed by something, you're slightly uneasy about something, you know, that little fly buzzing in the room is annoying me, I wish it wasn't there. That little tingle in my knee is annoying me, I wish it wasn't there. It's the same thing on a bigger continuum. So it's saying, so we'll pick annoyance. So it says, when annoyance is present in experience, be aware annoyance is present. When annoyance is not present in experience, be aware that it's not there. That's all it's asking us to do. This is the introspection of Vipassana meditation. You look into this moment's experience and you say, what's going on here? Is there annoyance there or not? Well, if it is there, then they say, you know, abandon it. And then feel what it's like to have abandoned it. Now, you can try to abandon the annoyance and it doesn't work. That happens from time to time. But there are also moments, at least, where you can, through an act of will, through an act of reinterpretation, through adjusting your attitude, adjusting your perspective, you can let go of annoyance for a moment. And one of the ways to do that is by cultivating mindfulness. Because mindfulness, again, by definition in the Abhidharma and in Buddhist psychology, mindfulness by definition is a moment of equanimity. Now, equanimity is that middle point between wanting and not wanting, between attraction and aversion, between, you know, wanting something and being annoyed by something. And so mindfulness is a way of cultivating the absence of greed and hatred. A moment of equanimity is by definition a moment of non-greed and a moment of non-hatred. And what that means is that anytime you have even a second of mindfulness, your mind is essentially in the same configuration as an awakened Buddha. Now, the difference between the Buddha and yourself is that you're going to lose it a minute later. Something else will annoy you because we're prone to annoyance. We haven't figured out getting rid of the causes. But certainly, there are moments of the absence of the symptom of annoyance. If you're in a moment where you're feeling equanimity, and you're not pushing anything away or pulling anything towards you, you're not judging anything, you like this, you don't like this, this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. There are moments where we can be poised, evenly hovering in the center. And I would argue that, as I understand the basic ideas behind the Buddhist analysis of mind, in that moment, you are awakened. Now, we have to be careful how we use words. You're not awakened in the sense that your greed, hatred, and delusion is gone for good, but you're awakened for an instant in the sense that in that moment, you are not suffering. Remember, one of the core definitions of suffering is not getting what you want and having to deal with what you don't want. And one of the key solutions to the cessation of suffering is to not want stuff anymore. If you don't want something, you're not going to suffer from not getting it, what you want. And if you don't not want something, in other words, if you feel aversion or annoyance towards something, I don't like that, I don't want that, if you don't feel that emotion, then you're not suffering in that moment either. So what this means for practice, as I understand it, is that the goal is to see if we can hold ourselves in the moment in such a way that annoyance drifts away and it's replaced by equanimity. And then experience that moment. What does it feel like to be temporarily awakened? In that moment, you're not suffering. Now, the pain in your knees still might be there. Remember, suffering and pain are two different things. You know, pain is really physiological. You know, the Buddha never said he's going to get your pain to go away. But suffering is different. Now, it's confusing in Pali because the word is the same for both. Dukkha means pain, and dukkha means this existential suffering or response to the pain. But as we know, you know, it's not about getting rid of pain, but it is about having equanimity within that pain. So there can be a moment when you're suffering because of the pain in your knee, but it can be followed by a moment in which you're not suffering, even though there's a pain in your knee. And that's the pinpoint. That's the slack line, if you will, that we're trying to walk in our practice, is simply, okay, what's going on in the mind and body right now? Is there something that I don't like? There's the annoyance. Aha. As the Satipatthana Sutta says, when annoyance is present in the mind, notice, be aware that annoyance is present. But you let go of it. You say, well, I'm not going to be annoyed about that particular thing in this particular moment. And if only for a moment, it subsides. Because everything changes, everything passes, everything subsides. So in the next moment that arises, there's still awareness, but the annoyance is gone. That is a moment devoid of hatred, devoid of one of the three toxins. Now, maybe there's greed has replaced it, or delusion has replaced it. I mean, you know, I'm a realist about this stuff. But the point is, as a practice, if we can experience even once what it feels like to be completely at ease in this moment, not because all the injustice in the world has been solved, not because your life has been sorted out, not because everything's fine, it's because in this moment, your mind is patterned around everything being fine. See what I mean? You haven't changed the external conditions, but you've changed your relationship to it. And so I think that, you know, this gives us a way to use the path not as something that gets us from here to there. You know, we're used to thinking about Buddhism as the path, the Eightfold Path. It's all heading for nirvana. We're all trying to get awakened. Instead, I see the path as this sort of line that we're walking on. And the future is all in fog and the past is all in fog. All we have is that thin line. And if we keep putting one foot on top of the other along that line, then we're balanced, we're poised, we're equanimity without suffering. When we step to the right, we want things and we feel the suffering. When we step to the left, we don't want things and we feel the suffering. So now practice becomes a line of equanimity that we can walk, such that when we fall one side or the other, we notice it and we pull ourselves back. And so we can actually sit for 45 minutes. And some percentage of that time, I don't want to quantify it too precisely, but some percentage of that time, we're already awakened and we're simply experiencing it. This all, of course, becomes a big theme later on in Buddhism, you know, the whole Japanese Zen thing. I'm sure many of you know the story of, you know, Dogen, one of the great founders of Soto Zen in Japan, you know, gets trained in the Tendai Buddhism of the time and says, well, if we're already enlightened, we all have Buddha nature, we're all inherently awakened, why do we have to practice? You know, why sit to get awakened? And he goes off to China and he practices in these Zen temples and he comes back with this solution. He says, we're not practicing so that we can become awakened. We're practicing as an expression of the fact that we're already awakened. What does an awakened being do? An awakened being sits in zazen. An awakened being sits there with their mind in equanimity. And I think he was onto something. I think he's onto the same point that I've been trying to say. In other words, we can be a Buddha, if only for a moment, you know? And then that becomes a useful tool, because if we manage for even one moment to be temporarily devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion, and to feel equanimity and feel well and feel like we're not suffering, if we can do that for one moment, why not another? Now the question becomes, what's it going to take for me to feel that again, or for me to sustain that feeling, or for me to hold my balance in such a way that I don't fall to the left or the right, but I stay on center, you know? And if you can do it 2 moments in a row, why not 3? Why not 4? And you're not grasping for anything. You're just trying to keep your balance. And this was actually one of the great metaphors, one of my favorite metaphors in the Pali text as well. In one of the sections on mindfulness, this is actually a metaphor for mindfulness, is the story of the bamboo acrobats. Remember that one? So this bamboo acrobat comes to a city with a bamboo pole, and he sets up his pole, and he climbs on top of it, and he balances. And then his little assistant climbs up the pole, climbs up on his shoulder, and she balances. And the idea is that they're keeping their balance. That's what mindfulness is. It's keeping your balance so that you don't fall towards wanting or not wanting, liking or not liking. You're simply aware of what's happening without favoring or opposing, without preferences. In these days, remember, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And then the little girl, you know, his assistant, he says to her, okay, you look over my balance and I'll look over, watch over your balance, and then we'll come down safely and get some payment for this. And she said, no, Master, you look after your balance and I'll look after my balance and then we'll be safe. In other words, you can, out of compassion, you can want to help this other person keep their balance. But what she needs to be safe is for the shoulder she's standing on to be stable. So if our practice becomes simply, how do we hold the center? How do we hold ourselves in such a way that in this instant at least, there's nothing that we're greedy or hateful about, there's nothing we're confused about, then that in itself is the practice, this practice of keeping your balance on that point. So I find that really useful as a way. And it's not just on the meditation cushion, you know. You can be out in the world and something happens. You know, there's some incident, you know, at work or in the family or in the street or whatever. Now, how do you hold yourself in that situation such that you're not being hateful, you're not being needy, you know, and so forth? So it works out in the world as well. And finally, I want to leave time for questions and discussion. How is this going to help save the world? Well, this is a simple model. If we're looking now at not persons who are awakened or not, but moments that are awakened or not, we can extrapolate out to other people. So if my mind for 45 minutes of sitting, you know, is all over the place and I'm grinding my teeth about that jerk that said that stupid thing to me or whatever, then, you know, maybe, you know, 99% of that time I'm not really meditating. I'm meditating in the sense that I'm, you know, on the field playing baseball, but I'm not getting the ball. And so in that sense, there's no continuity of that. I lost my train of thought there. Right, so in the moment, the question is, what is the percentage of mind moments that have greed, hatred, and delusion in them versus the ones that don't? And again, to begin with, I might be grinding my teeth the whole time thinking about something, but even if for a moment I'm able to feel, or for a few moments in a row, really feel this tranquility, this peace of mind and so forth, and then the storm comes back, I've learned something, I've gained something, I've gotten a glimpse of something. And so then as I practice more, you know, you don't want to be striving for that or trying to recreate it, but you want to learn, how did you get there? And then learn to get there again. Maybe hold it for a few more moments, a few more. You might get to the point where for 45 minutes, really most of that time, you're sitting there as an enlightened being. In the sense, an awakened being, in the sense that your mind is not generating these toxic states. It's generating these more positive states or this equanimity. So if that's the case, now, you know, one time, some of you know, I wrote an article once about mind moments, and I calculated that in a lifetime, we have 10 billion mind moments, okay? I won't go into the math, but... So, you know, if, I think what happened for the Buddha is after age, what was it, 36, when he got awakened, every single one of his mind moments was awakened. And before that, it was a mixed bag like the rest of us. So, and I think this is how rebirth works. You know, if most of your mind moments are sort of nasty, you're going to get reborn in a nasty place because you're a nasty person. If most of your mind moments are lovely, you're going to get reborn in a lovely place because you're a lovely person. There's no judging. It just goes automatically to whatever you become. So in the same way, the way that I can best contribute to the world's well-being is by having the highest percentage possible of mind moments that are devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, we're going to be easy on ourselves. There's plenty of times when I'm going to screw it up and it's justified and my anger is righteous and so forth. But by and large, a spiritual life, as I understand it, is one dedicated to trying to improve yourself, trying to be a better person. And if I can be the best person I can be at any given situation, in any given moment, both in public and in private on the cushion, then I'm transforming myself into a person with a much higher percentage, let's say, of unafflicted mind moments. Now, the same thing happens for everyone else. So picture, for just as a thought experiment, what if everybody in the world had uninterrupted mind stream in which no greed, hatred, and delusion arose? Then we'd have an awakened society, a collective awakening. We'd all be awakened. And I suspect, frankly, that that's where we're headed eventually. But as we know, there's so many of us, so many of them, who are just got these toxins that just keep coming up, you know? And so the collective agenda is, how do we keep these toxic states from arising all over the place? It's easy to, you know, get angry about how angry those people are getting, but that's not going to work. So then we ask ourselves, well, under what circumstances does greed arise in a person? Greed and hatred we'll take as an example. Well, greed and hatred, greed is there for a reason. It serves an evolutionary purpose. When a person is lacking something, they want it. And that want, that desire, drives their motivation to get what they need. So it's a survival mechanism. There's nothing evil about it or wrong about it. So if we want people to not be greedy, what's the practical solution? Create the conditions so that they're not in need, so that they don't want. If they're not starving, they're not going to grab for food. If they're not disrespected, they're not going to grab for respect. You know, so let's use this model to create better conditions out there. How do you make sure that people don't get hateful and angry and violent and so forth? Well, why do we have this instinct to get violent and angry and hateful? It's a protection mechanism. It's worked for a long time, ever since the dinosaurs. You know, something threatens you, you fight it, you know? Well, we don't want people to fight all the time, so what do? What's it going to take to put them in a circumstance so that they don't feel threatened? Then they won't get angry. Then they won't get violent. Then they won't get aggressive. So what's it going to take so that a person feels safe? They feel understood. They feel like somebody's not taking. So somebody walks in from out of town, out of the tribe, with a different complexion, a different religion, a different race or whatever. If you think that person's going to rob me, steal from me, hurt me, and so forth, you're going to be aggressive to them. What's it going to take to educate them that that person's not a threat? And if they're not a threat, then they'll be kindly to them, and so forth. So what I'm trying to suggest, and I know this is a little naive, but just that using this model of looking at enlightened versus unenlightened, awakened or unawakened mind states, both in the individual and in the collective, the issue becomes, what has to happen in order to cultivate mind moments that are devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion? What are the conditions causing the greed, hatred, and delusion to get stronger and manifest? And how can we change those conditions so that it moves it in the other direction? And I think this is a blueprint for engaged Buddhism. It's a blueprint for social change. It's simply looking objectively at the rising and passing phenomena, which is really all that's going on, understanding the laws of cause and effect under this circumstance that naturally occurs. When that doesn't happen, that doesn't occur. That's the basic principle of interdependence, interdependent origination. And then we apply it to the issue of cleansing the mind of its toxic states, both individually and collectively. And it might take a long time, but that's okay, you know? And the progress is guaranteed to be incremental. We can't make any large changes. But as we know, the power of patience, the power of persistence, the importance of diligence, if everyone learns and is committed to incrementally changing the texture, the quality of their minds, and that becomes contagious to other minds, it's going to eventually change everything for the better.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.